All right, with that, well, let's move to item 10, which is our educational presentation on fiduciary duties presented by our fiduciary counsel, Harvey Lederman, who may, I don't know, Harvey, are you going to be joined by Mai or no?
No, Maytag's not going to be joining this morning. You get me. And good morning to everyone. And Scott, when you opened the meeting by talking about the happy part of the meeting, I thought that was going to be my cue, but no, it was Luz Casas. Congratulations to Luz.
Yes.
For a long time, as to Sarah, that's terrific to congratulate her on that. Thanks very much. I'm going to, I don't know, is Christina controlling the screen?
She just there enabled sharing in Europe.
Oh, there we go. Perfect. And can everyone hear my audio?
Yes. Yes, we can.
Excellent. Thanks so much. Again, good morning. I look forward to these conversations. What I want to do today is touch on, obviously, some of the fundamentals of fiduciary responsibilities of this board, as we have talked in a number of times. And I'm delighted that we have a few new board members since last year. And I encourage you to interrupt and ask questions and anything that comes to mind as we talk through some of these fiduciary responsibilities, which you don't have yet on the screen, and which I'm going to spend most of the time talking about is an actual case study right here in California with one of our sister systems. On breach of fiduciary duty and what a tortured path that has been, 12 years of litigation that I want to condense for you and kind of bring you the kernel of what a breach of fiduciary duty case looks like when brought by one of our, against one of our retirement boards. If we can go to the next slide, Christina, is that you controlling?
Yep, she just moved.
Great. Okay, perfect. So just to get ourselves rooted again in the idea of fiduciary responsibilities, you, as you know, you all serve as trustees of this now, what do we have, $13 billion assets under management and benefits for thousands of retirees and thousands of active members who will eventually become retirees. Very solemn responsibility. And these are the fundamental fiduciary responsibilities that you have that the law imposes on you. It's constitutional. It's that important to the people of the state of California that your responsibilities are etched into the state's constitution, not just in statutory law, not just in common law. First and foremost is the duty of loyalty. Regardless of how you come to this virtual boardroom, if you will, whether you're an active member or retired member or appointed or a board of supervisor, when you walk through, again, this virtual door, we're all in virtual reality these days, you take that hat off. You're not, this isn't representative democracy. It's not Congress. Your responsibility shifts away from the people who got you on this board to the people who benefit from the retirement system, and that is the members and their beneficiaries. That is the first and primary responsibility. We have to keep that foremost in mind, because a lot of times you're going to have a lot of decisions to make that may promote other people's interests, more importantly, and those you need to park in favor of the interests of the members of this trust. All the exclusive benefit rule says is that those $13 billion worth of assets that you shepherd, that those are to be used only to pay benefits and reasonable administrative expenses, not any other purpose. It can't be devoted to accomplish any purpose other than to pay benefits. In terms of process, this board has a duty of prudence It sounds vague. It sounds like it could be anything that you want it to be, but it's not really. It's supposed to be an objective standard for how you conduct yourselves. And in doing that, you're supposed to use care and skill that a knowledgeable, prudent person would use under the same circumstances that you're faced with when you make your decisions. Fundamentally, you're there to assure the competency of the assets of the trust to meet the benefit payments. And you do that prudently. This duty of prudence is a process duty. If you were the controller of the state of New York and the only trustee of the New York Common Fund, hard to believe, but there is a single individual who is the trustee of the entire state common fund, that the process by which that individual trustee makes decisions is very different than the process that this body as collective trustees have to engage in. And you have to act collectively for the benefit of the members. And the process that you engage in, how you govern yourselves, how you regard yourselves, the respect that you give each other to listen to diverse opinions is particularly relevant to a pension fund like this one, where there are 9, 10, sometimes 11 trustees who are charged with coming together with a consensus and making prudent decisions. You have to do it together. Very important. And historically, this board has seen times when that was challenged. Many of you will remember those times. And then you've had several years now where you've been able to accomplish the work of the board collectively, respectfully, and through following really good governance processes. And I congratulate you on that. You've really distinguished yourselves in the duty of prudence in that regard. Rounding out the fundamental fiduciary responsibilities, you're responsible for diversifying the investments. The people of the state of California entrusting you with these assets has decided that modern portfolio theory should guide your investments. And that simply means that you look at risk-reward trade-offs. You must diversify the portfolio unless it's not prudent to diversify the portfolio. I can't imagine a time when that is true, but there are some times when you needn't be a slave to diversification. You don't have to necessarily diversify into every single potential subclass of assets, subcategory of assets, but a broad diversification of the portfolio is considered over the long run to be in the best interests of the system. And ultimately, you have a responsibility to follow the law. As you know, this system is a tax-qualified system under federal tax laws. There are certain requirements that the feds impose on us. For example, and how to run the system and the use of the assets. Those are all written into our plan documents, and your obligation is to follow the plan documents. That includes your policies and regulations. It includes fundamental trust law. It is very important, critical, that the board follow its plan documents, maintain its tax-qualified status, and carry out its fiduciary responsibilities. I've kind of gathered these in the next slide. Thank you, Christina. Under different pillars, fiduciary pillars, and I don't want to go over every one of these, but the five in blue there, the five pillars are the five fiduciary responsibilities that I just talked about. And then you can see that under each pillar, there are different responsibilities in terms of how to go about satisfying those fiduciary responsibilities. So you can look at it this way. There's another way to also to look at it, and that's in the next slide. And that's in one of your key governing documents. Christina, slide 4, please. And I think that was attached to the agenda backup this morning, and that is your code of fiduciary conduct and ethics. This very much synchronizes with the 5 pillars of fiduciary responsibilities. And you can see that some of these are process, due process responsibilities. Disclosing conflicts of interest. I talked about how you have to govern collectively. You owe it to each other that if you believe that you have a conflict of interest, which means that you're taking into consideration somebody else's interests other than the members, that you'll disclose that to your colleagues and you'll recuse yourself when it's appropriate and timely. That's a process requirement under your fiduciary responsibilities. Honoring a quiet period, number 6, during investment manager searches. Again, another part of the process of being a good fiduciary and exercising independent thoughts and respecting the role of your colleagues. Critically important for a collective trust. Maintaining the confidentiality of closed sessions. So I urge you to go back and look at the code of fiduciary conduct every once in a while. It doesn't have a lot of pictures in it, but it's got a lot of good language, and it gives you a gyroscope with which to reset your course sometimes when you're considering decisions that the board has to make. Go back to this document and say, you know, am I abiding by the code of conduct and ethics that we've established for ourselves as board members? So let's go to the next slide, Christina, 5, which you haven't seen yet. What I want to do is bring to you and briefly true story here. We have one of our colleague systems in the SACRS world, the SERL system, Stanislaus County Retirement System, not as large as this system in terms of assets under management, but Scott, go ahead.
No, I'm good.
Oh, okay, good. I thought you had a hand. We had a case. I've been fiduciary counsel and litigation counsel to Stanislaus, Stan Sarah, it's called in short, headquartered in Modesto. We had a case that was brought in 2009, 12 years ago, a breach of fiduciary duty case. We have been up and down to the Court of Appeals 3 times now in this case. And the case is a very good education in how a board goes about in an emergency situation making decisions that impact the system, get questioned by members, and survives a breach of fiduciary challenge. This case examined whether that board, the Stancera board, breached its fiduciary duties of loyalty, the first duty, and prudence, when it took emergency measures during the Great Recession. Remember the 2008, 2009, it now seems like history, but with this case, we've been going through it for 12 years. And let me tell you a little bit about what this case was about, what happened, and what we had to go through to demonstrate that the board satisfied its fiduciary responsibility.
Hey, Harvey, your audio is cutting out a little bit. I don't know whether that's a function of the mic. I don't know if anybody else is having trouble, but I just wanted to alert you that there's a little of that occurring.
Okay, I'll try to get a little bit closer to the...
There you go. That sounds a little better.
To the mic, yeah. I don't even know where the mic is on my computer, but...
I just shout. It's
just shout out. Okay, so let's go to slide 6, Christina. Stan Serra was a system not unlike Contra Costa. Up until the Great Recession, it was maybe 90% funded, maybe a little bit more. And over the years, it had put aside, some of you may remember, we used to have a phrase that we don't use ever since that recession called excess earnings. Yeah. So when you beat your bogey every year, and maybe you set your bogey at, let's say, 7%, and you make 8%, you take the 1%, you call it excess earnings, and you park it in non-valuation reserves. And that's what many of our SACR systems did for years up until the Great Recession. Stan Serra moved so much money into excess earnings reserves that by 2008, it represented a third of all the assets of the system. And that money was used not to pay promised retirement benefits, but to pay supplemental benefits to retirees, cost of living additions, medical subsidies, all kinds of things that were allowed by law. But that money was not being used to fund retirement benefits, promised benefits. It was being used for these supplemental benefits. And the county went along with that. The county thought that was fine because contribution rates were not so high, even though the county was literally contributing a lot more than they otherwise would have had to. Those earnings had been used to reduce unfunded liability and pay for promised retirement benefits. In fact, the county had floated a pension obligation bond a few years before to actually pay off its unfunded liability. Well, when the Great Recession hit, a couple of things happened. Of course, the county was hit with a real estate crisis, and tax revenues plummeted in Stanislaus County. At the same time, the retirement system lost about a third of the value of its assets, of its valuation assets, and had the retirement board set the employer contributions to recognize that loss, even smoothed over 5 years, it would have cranked up the employer contributions, the county's contributions, so high that it would have threatened the county with bankruptcy. The county, at the height of the Great Recession, was laying off a lot of employees. Members were losing their jobs. People were forced into early retirement, and this was all having a death spiral effect on the retirement system. So in 2009, the board made some very difficult decisions. And basically what the board did was take these excess earnings reserves, not all of them, but maybe a third of them, and applied them to the unfunded liability to reduce the county's burden on contributing to the unfunded liability, used the money also to credit against county contributions, stop paying these supplemental benefits, and not pay them again until they got to 100% funded. They also looked at the amortization schedule. They were down to about a 20-year amortization, so they lengthened the unfunded liability amortization to 30 years. And then they backloaded the contributions somewhat by changing to level percent of pay amortization methodology instead of level dollar methodology. All of these acts had the impact of reducing the county's burden and stopping, preventing further job losses and early retirements. So you can imagine the retirees were unhappy with this, because money that had been skimmed off, if you will, for supplemental benefits had now been used to help ease the financial burden on the county. And after these acts happened in 2009, a group of disgruntled retirees got a hold of one of the most notorious lawyers from San Diego and filed a lawsuit against the board. And it was a breach of fiduciary duty lawsuit. It was alleged that what the board did was essentially favor the county over the members. That it was not in the members' interest to do what the board did, but that the board essentially rolled over to the county and allowed the county to raid, if you will, raid the pension fund for its own budgetary purposes, contrary to the Constitution and Prop 162. And that this was imprudent management of the system. In fact, the argument was that what the retirement board should have done, faced with these terrible losses in the value of the fund, was to bring in more county money, not less county money, and certainly not to use funds of the system simply to reduce county contributions. That was the argument. We first got the case dismissed on its face. That was appealed to the Court of Appeals the first time around in 2013. Court of Appeals said, you know what, we think there's enough here that you really should go further in the case, so we're not going to throw it out on the face of the complaint. Develop the case a little bit more. So we went back to court, developed the facts for another couple of years, filed a motion for summary judgment that there were no factual disputes, and as a matter of law, the board didn't do anything wrong. Went the trial court threw the case out on summary judgment in favor of the board, saying it did not breach its fiduciary duty. Went up to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals said, well, you know, everything the board did, it had the legal right to do. But you could interpret what it did. It would be plausible to interpret what it did as favoring the county. And even though the acts were lawful, they still could be a breach of fiduciary duty to the members by not putting the members' interests first and foremost. So we want you to go back to trial and actually have a full trial on the case and not just summarily throw it out. So the Court of Appeals in 2017 sent us back to the trial court. Even though the Court of Appeals said everything the board did, the amortization, the use of excess earnings to move it into reducing county contributions, the way it credited those earnings, those were all lawful and permitted by the CERL, the statute. Nevertheless, it's possible that a trial court could find that it breached your primary duty of loyalty to members and it was imprudent under the circumstances. So we went back to trial. 2018, we held trial. We had a two-week trial. We had expert witnesses testifying. We had county testifying about job losses and their budgetary constraints and how bad it would be for members if they could not meet their responsibility over the long run. Trial judge wrote a 58-page opinion and said the board properly met its fiduciary duty of loyalty to members because it was in the members' interest to keep the county solvent and to preserve their jobs. And that the board went through a proper due process to manage the system, considered all the alternatives, had been advised by fiduciary counsel, had been advised by actuaries that it was actuarially sound what they did. And the trial court ruled that the board did not breach its fiduciary duty. Well, of course, we went back up to the Court of Appeals again at the behest of the disgruntled retirees. And last month, the Court of Appeals, panels are always three judges. This was the third time up to the Court of Appeals. Two of the three judges had been on each of the other decisions over the last 9 years. So they knew this case pretty well. It came back to haunt them again. In December, they wrote another 50-page opinion. And Christine, let's go to the next slide, please. Slide 7. It's our last slide. This is what the court ruled. It reiterated its prior decision and said that everything the board did was lawful. It had the right to make these decisions. The question was, did it breach its fiduciary duty to the members, beneficiaries? And the court said the trial court below got it right. There was substantial evidence supporting the judgment in favor of the board. That when you're looking at what is in the member's best interest, you must look beyond just what will pay short-term member benefits. Members' job security, in other words, being able to keep the job that entitles them to earn retirement benefits, was a valid interest for the board to consider in satisfying its duty of loyalty. Furthermore, the solvency and long-term stability of the county as the plan sponsor, as the payer of employer contributions, the solvency over the long-term of the county was also in the members' best interest. And so when the board considered all these things, the trial court found, the Court of Appeals upheld, that it was primarily in the members' best interests for the board to do what it did. And finally, the Court of Appeals said the board followed a prudent process. And go back to that very important process part of a collective board, considered all the viable options, had testimony. We had five board meetings in 2009. Where the board solicited the views of retirees and actives and the county and had great debate among itself. And that process, the Court of Appeals found, was prudent and in the long-term best interests of the system, which was in the members' interests as well. So I can give you a few takeaways from this case. As I say, this is a real case. This is a real instruction manual to a board like this board on how to satisfy the duty of loyalty and how to run a prudent process in making difficult decisions. I will also tell you that I hope that no CERL system ever again uses the phrase excess earnings. It's a myth. If you assume a 7% rate of return over a long period of time and you get 8 in 1 year, you can be sure that there will be reversion to the mean and you're going to get 6 in another year. But if you skim that 1% off in that 1 year and park it and call it excess earnings, you're not going to be able to get back to 7 on a regular basis. So this whole idea of excess earnings as being in the, while it's in the short-term interests of current retirees, your responsibility is to steward the plan and balance the interests of both current and future retirees as well. So it's a good instruction manual for the use of the earnings of the system and the ability to balance the generations of members that you're responsible to. So that's pretty much the lesson for today. The duty of loyalty is extremely important to how you govern yourselves, and it will be enforced by the courts. This was a long, long process. It's not over yet. We're waiting. Next week is the deadline for the plaintiffs in the case to decide whether they want to petition to the Supreme Court to have the case reviewed by the California Supreme Court. And we'll just wait and see what happens. But this has been 12 years of litigation, three trips from the trial court to the Court of Appeals. And as one of the trustees in the Stansara board told me last week, he said, you know, we knew we were right all along. Why did it take so damn long to prove it? This is what happens when you go down this route in litigation. It can be costly, it can be distracting, it can be time consuming. Ultimately, though, you can rest assured that if you follow a decent process, that the courts are not going to second guess the prudent decision making of the board. With that, I'd like to flip it over, Scott, to anyone who has any questions, happy to respond. And thank you for letting me bring this case study to the board this morning.
Fascinating case. Well, that's one way to look at it. Fascinating. Mike Sloan has his hand up. So Mike, go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to mention, Harvey, that I know the principal plaintiff, Michael O'Neill. I know him personally.
Yeah.
Through CRCEA, we have been apprised of this case from the day one when it first started. Usually on at least a twice annual basis. And this is the first time that, you know, I've ever heard the complete story. It's like, they've always said that there's two sides to a story. And I really appreciate your review of this because it definitely gives a totally different aspect of what took place in the case versus what I've heard in the past. So thank you for that.
Well, what's unusual is, I have a great relationship with Michael O'Neill as well, and we've gotten to know each other on both sides of this. And he was he served as the board chair last year in Stanislaus, so we've gotten to know each other pretty well. You will hear a different story from them, of course. The other part of this that I didn't mention is that they were partially funded. It was a contingency case that the lawyer took on, but the costs were funded by the Retiree Association in Stanislaus. And they're now going to be responsible for about $30,000 in our costs that the Court of Appeals awarded to us. So it's not a free ride for the Retiree Association. Ironically, in 2009, at one of these board meetings, Mr. O'Neill, who became the plaintiff, actually argued in favor of exactly what the board did. So that didn't help him when I was cross-examining him on a witness stand.
Likely not. Wow. Well, you know, this case is, to me, one of the takeaways was I thought of it as the Golden Goose case, which is that a board, if it acts prudently to protect the goose that's laying the eggs, is actually benefiting the system and in long term benefits the members, right?
Yeah.
It sounded to me like it had that undertone.
Yeah, it was very important to establish that it isn't a zero sum game. You can't argue that what's good for the county is bad for the members, because the county is the employer who provides the jobs by which the retirement benefits are earned. And if the county, you know, can't do that and demonstrate in this case that it couldn't do that,
right,
then the members are harmed. And so it's not a zero sum by any means. And ultimately the courts got that. But that was the argument that was thrown up. If it's good for the county, it's bad for us. And, it, you know, fortunately, well, It's not that easy of an equation.
Right. Fascinating. Yeah. It's a manual. All right. I'm going to read this case when I have some time. Sounds like I'll need some time.
Wait for the movie version.
Yes. Now, dying to see who is casted as you. Any other questions or comments for Harvey on this, or on the presentation, or on the subject matter in general? It looks like not. So thank you, Harvey.
Very, all right. Thank you very much.
As always.
And let's we'll segue to the next educational session.